Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Bertha Rogers. Rogers is a poet, visual artist, educator, and translator. More than 250 of her poems have appeared in dozens of literary journals, collections, and magazines, including the Connecticut Review, Midwest Quarterly, Green Mountain Review, and Yankee Magazine. She has been awarded several residency fellowships, including at the McDowell Colony and the Millay Colony for the Arts in New York. She has also published several chapbooks and collections, and her most recent is called Heart Turned Back, published by Salmon Poetry Press in Ireland. In 1992, Rogers and her husband, Ernest Fishman, founded Bright Hill Press and Literary Center in Treadwell, New York. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I want you to tell us a bit about your early years. Were you encouraged to be creative as a young child, and is that how it all started?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and I was encouraged to work. That's what you do on farms. Uh-huh. But I love to read, so I was always, it's the family history that if anybody wanted to find me, they could find me in the haymow or the apple tree or somewhere reading somewhere. Uh-huh. And I drew a lot.
So you were always interested in literature. Okay. Well, so you're a poet and a visual artist. Well, which came first for you? Did you discover one first and then the other? Or?
No, you know, I think I remember doing them always and always wanting to be a poet and a visual artist. And that's what I did.
So you started writing as a child, or did you wait until you got into school?
No, I was in school, but as a young child, yes, I was writing then.
And what were your early subjects? Do you remember?
I was very spiritual. I was writing, when I was about 12, I wrote this long, epic sort of God poem, which fortunately has disappeared.
But you still remember it.
I remember writing it. Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You seem to be attracted a lot to nature as well. It must be because of the farm influence.
It probably is. And I live on a little mountain in the western Catskills now, and I really like being out there. So, yeah. And I planted a lot of trees. About 2,500 trees and shrubs when I moved up from New York in 89.
Wow.
I went crazy planting trees.
Well, that's a spiritual part of life, too. The whole outdoors and the poetry. What about the visual art? What did you start with? Drawing with a pencil? What was the format?
I think it was a pencil. I remember my aunt who had, she liked to draw, and she would show me how to draw rabbits, things like that. You know, little quick rabbits and cats.
Little sketches.
I remember that very well. And then I remember trying to get faces right by using the lids of jars to get them perfectly round.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
That is funny. God, pumpkin heads.
Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit how you approach poetry. Do lines come into your head, or do you just think of a subject that you want to approach? How do you do it?
Well, sometimes lines come into my head, but more often it's an idea or suddenly a moment that you say, oh, this is important, this is something to remember. And then I take notes. I just take notes. Usually a poem takes me a long time.
But you're so prolific.
Well, it's part of that process. If you don't do it, I think Rilke said, you know, if you don't do it when they come to you, at least take the notes, then pretty soon they don't come anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have to be aware of it. John Burroughs, the naturalist, always said you had to have sharp eyes, and I think that's part of it. You have to pay attention.
Yeah, and you have to capture the moment before it passes.
So I'll take notes, and then I'll go back to it, and I'll say, what's this?
Wow. Now, when you start feeling the need to express yourself somehow, something needs to come out of you, do you know when it's going to be a poem or a painting or a drawing? Can you tell the difference between the feelings?
Yeah, I think a poem is a different experience. It often comes as an idea that I know will be a poem, but it might be a difficult process. And a drawing is I see something I want to draw. And so it's a little different.
Yeah, so the artwork doesn't necessarily come from emotions the way poetry often does.
No, I don't think so. I often think of a theme in terms of visual art. So I'll do a whole series, and it may not start as a series, but once I've started one or two things, for instance, back in the 80s, I did some walking tours in England and around stone circles. I was studying stone circles, and I did a huge series of stone circle pieces.
Mm.
And then finally, it took me 2 or 3 years, and then finally that was done.
2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I did a lot of pieces. A lot of pieces.
Wow, that's amazing that you can find so much in such a small little portion of thought.
I think it's not the large thing that gets me either. It's always the small thing in both writing and visual art. The landscape is not something that is too interesting to me. It might be something really small within the landscape.
So you zoom in on little tiny pieces,
say,
almost like a
yes.
microscope.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I do want you to read a piece from your current book called Heart Turned Back, and this is a really lovely one called The Future. Can you read that for us?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about it before you read it.
Okay, this is from my childhood, actually, and it talks about this tree, which there was, and we used to play at that tree, and basically that's what it's about,
okay.
The future. There was a great tree, gigantic old oak, across the lane's ditch, just before a fence that outlined the bleak, snapping Turtle Creek. Darkness stirred there like a snake through green. We children invented futures in that marled palisade, adopted acorn babies, infants who did not cry, complain, whine, who required no thrashings. In this present, this not, lawns are unmowed, troughs rife with weeds and despond, dust blowing up leaves like accusers' voices. The oak, its pocketed offspring are gone. Seeds flown downward, questions unanswered.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. Now, a lot of your poems seem to be about memory. Would you say a lot of your stuff is autobiographical?
I would say yes, uh-huh. Definitely.
And that's deliberate. You're not writing about the present so much, but bringing the past into the present?
It's very hard for me to write about the present in the present. I can take the notes, but I have to go back to it. I'm envious of people who can write about the present in the present. It's very hard for me to do that.
Uh-huh.
I need some remove from it.
So do you need a lot of remove from your childhood in order to have started writing about that as well?
Yes. It's taken me a long, long time to write about my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Are you somebody who finds herself censoring herself the way some writers talk about, you've got to get rid of the censor in order to really be honest in writing?
Well, sometimes I do, but it's very rare. If I write something that is close to somebody I'm close to that I think might offend or hurt that person, it's not that I won't write it. I'll write it. But I won't necessarily read it out loud in a reading or something.
But what about having it published? Would the person probably know
I've done it, and people have said things to me, and I've just, that's the way it is. But I don't read them out in public. But I do, if I think it's a really good poem worth doing, I'll publish it.
Huh. That's fascinating to me. Who looks over your work? Do you have an editor? Do you have a friend? Do you have
No, I'm my editor.
Really?
I'm a very strict editor.
You don't have anybody critiquing it for you, though, huh?
No, I never have done that, never.
So you only show it to people when it's finished?
Yes. Wow. I don't read them till I consider them finished either. Never.
You mean out loud?
Yes, out loud.
Yeah. I can understand that.
Yeah.
And certainly you probably don't have them published until you know for sure every word is
no,
in place.
No, and then sometimes I realize I've made a mistake and I rewrite it anyway after it's published.
Oh, so Bertha Rogers' revised editions are going to be coming out at some point.
Oh, well.
Now, I know you actually give poetry workshops for children, and I was wondering, how do you approach the language of poetry with really small children? Because it is its own language.
It is, and I work with kids K through 12. I've done college teaching. I really love kids. I never condescend to them. I'll read Elizabeth Bishop or Rilke to children, little kids, to kindergartners, and I'll stop in the middle and I'll say, this word means this, you know. There's The Fish, for instance, that famous Bishop poem where she talks about catching a fish. And the kids, even what they don't get, they get. So I don't read junk to them ever.
Uh-huh. It's amazing how children do seem to understand that language.
They do.
And they're not intimidated by it, and they don't censor themselves.
No,
the way
not
so many
at all.
Adults do.
No. I have a group of sixth graders in New York writing love poems this week, which, you know, brings up the usual silly stuff. But I read them Japanese poems translated by Kenneth Rex Roth first.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And so it sort of gives them, it's not really a prompt, but something like that.
So children's love poems, I would think, would be in the most part about their pets.
The girls often write about boys, sixth graders.
Oh, sixth graders.
Okay. Anonymously, of course. And the boys will write about something else, you know, their Wi-Fi, something, their Wii or their DS. They'll write about those things.
Love poems to their Wi-Fi?
Yeah, yeah.
My, how times have changed.
Well, I give them that because it's embarrassing to them. So I say, okay, so write a love poem to a thing, because I don't believe anything is inanimate anyway. I believe everything is alive.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I do too. Yeah. I'm not going to embarrassingly tell you what kind of things that I name, but.
Doesn't matter. Whatever you say, I've probably done it myself.
Well, I'd love you to read another piece from Heart Turned Back. This one's called Elemental, and it's dedicated to your mother. And it's a really disturbing poem to me. Tell us a little bit about it before you read it.
Well, when I was a little girl, we had our house burned down. I was a very small girl. And maybe about three, and the house burned down, and my mother was alone with us, the little kids, and my father was working, and they had no phone and no running water, nothing like that.
Wow.
And she was doing laundry, I think, and the fire, something caught fire, and everything burned. She was able to pull out a few things. That's it. And there wasn't any way to call anybody because it was out in the country.
Uh-huh.
And by the time my father got home and everybody else got there, there were just a couple of things left.
Wow. Well, that's a disturbing poem for a reason.
Yeah, and I've always been terrified of fire ever since. So it is dedicated to her because you'll hear what she managed to save out of the fire. Elemental. By logic, it's fire I hate. Heat that destroys unstoppable vermilion teeth. But I don't remember the morning our house burned down, its few furnishings, vertical licks, the table, velour chair, their wedding fostoria melted to its beginnings. And we small sisters, clinging, crying in the fringe grass while our mother pumped water, heaved buckets, the feverish rubble, scorched galaxy. She tells the story, how she managed to save the console radio, the Singer sewing machine, how our father, home from the night shift, found basking ash, bent tin. I should despise fire, but I'm drawn to flame, the way it enhances, then reduces all to essence. His arms holding us, holding her, all four of us harmonious, fearful, and relieved. The cornfield flourished round the smoking plot. The war in Europe raged. Even the crows wheeled and cawed outside our little circle.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Did you call up other things besides what you put in that poem? Was that a difficult thing to write?
I'd heard that story, and of course I really don't remember it.
Mm.
I'm assuming that we were crying. I'm sure we were. And I'm sure she put us aside out of the way while she was dragging things out. Mm-hmm. And she's told us what she dragged out. And the rest of it I sort of put together from my childhood, from living on a farm, the cornfield, and uh-huh. the way things were.
Well, what did your mother read the poem?
Oh, yeah, she's read it, yeah.
What did she think of it?
She liked it. She liked it.
Uh-huh. It wasn't disturbing for her to see that on paper.
No, it wasn't. I think she was glad to see it on paper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cathartic,
I think,
in some
yeah.
way. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bertha Rogers. She's a poet, and she's the founder of the Bright Hill Press and Literary Center in Treadwell, New York. Now, I once heard a poet say that the first-person I that she used in her work was not really her, and she used it in order to find universal ways of communicating. How do you feel about that? Do you do the same thing?
Sometimes, sometimes not. Sometimes the I is myself,
uh-huh.
and sometimes it's I speak in other voices, yeah.
Uh-huh. 'Cause I, you know, most people that read poetry would think the I is you speaking about your life, and
yes.
they all think it's autobiographical.
And, you know, yeah, they do, they often do, but people who read a lot of poetry, I think, have a more, they more likely understand that it may not be. For instance, if you're writing about a painting, and if you're writing about a subject in a painting, if you were writing about the Mona Lisa, you might describe yourself as sitting there for Leonardo and what it felt like, but mm-hmm. obviously it wouldn't be you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Now, you do a lot of the artwork, and almost all the artwork for your books, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do the paintings get painted after you've completed the collection? How do you deal with that?
Sometimes, and sometimes there's something I've done in the past that seems to work very well with the collection.
Uh-huh.
So it's some of both.
Uh-huh. And this book the latest book is very autobiographical, and it seems somewhat dark, but the cover is really beautiful and light and almost like flames.
Yes,
I have to say.
Actually, this was my interpretation of a tree by the side of a road that was being ripped out. And so it's called Roots, I think. I called this Roots. And so what it is the roots, the exposed roots. So it does look like flame, but it's
a beautiful cover.
Thank you.
It's a
thank
really
you
beautiful
very
cover.
Much.
Now, let's talk about the Bright Hill Press and Literary Center. I'm fascinated that you founded this back in 1992. What was the reason why you decided you needed to found a whole literary organization?
Well, of course, it didn't start like that.
Right, right.
But
tell
I had
us about
moved,
the history.
I had moved up from Manhattan in 1989, and I read a lot in open mics and featured readings in the city. And I found after a couple of years that I really missed it. And I met my husband up here, and he was interested, and we decided to, okay, let's try a reading series.
Mm.
And so then, like Topsy, it grew. It grew to become much more than a reading series. But the reading series, Word Thursdays, has always been sort of the bones of the organization.
Uh-huh. And so you found people that were hungry for this kind of an organization.
You know, I put a little press release in the local, the Oneonta paper, saying on such and such there was going to be a reading and people could come and read in the open mic. And that's what it was, and people came.
And so then it evolved into a press and all kinds of educational endeavors. Tell us about how that evolved.
Well, I think it was a couple of years later, we'd already had a lot of people reading. We were doing a festival, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to commemorate the people who had been features? So we did our first anthology, which is a small anthology called the Speaking the Words Anthology.
Mm.
And that was people who had been featured mostly in that festival. And then, of course, it grows because then you want to do more. You want to do more anthologies. You want to do more of individual poetry. And we've published some wonderful, wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just great how many terrific people we've published. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, it's a great service. Are you somebody like so many others in this culture worried about the fact that we're losing our language and people aren't quite as literate? I mean, you probably don't see that since you have the Bright Hill Literary.
I don't, you know, and I don't see it with the kids I work with throughout the state.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to, you know, they seem to be very interested in words, and they're reading all the time, which is fabulous. They're reading the Rick Riordan, the Lightning Thief, and which are based on mythology, and they're reading all these wonderful series. So they seem to be, the kids I know are reading a lot, which is terrific.
That is great. A communique from a place that's very positive, because I hear so much negativity, especially from teachers.
Well, I have to say, you know, I walk in the classroom and I'll say, how many of you have read the Rick Riordan series, which is four or five books based on mythology, which this kid named Percy Jackson, who's really Perseus, you know, and they're half gods. And, you know, you'll have 2/3 of the class raise their hands. And to me, that's fabulous.
That is really great news.
Yeah, makes me happy.
Well, let's have you read one more from Hark Turn Back.
Okay.
This one's called In the Catskills, and it's a really lovely piece.
This is one of my favorite poems, and this comes from hiking down by Woodstock, Cornell, Slide, and Whitney. And there are three mountains, and it comes from that, from a hike I took and a hemlock I saw. It was called In the Catskills. Even the hemlock grows indifferent to life, dies standing, keeping his secret for untold prideful years. The trees' needles diminish, bark and heartwood degenerate to dust. When the north wind hears of this, he offers a parting kiss, and the tree falls into the arms of his fellows, who carry the corpse on their gnarled shoulders, 100 years procession, a stately bearing back to the mountain's body.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Really beautiful. You are attracted to nature.
I am.
There's no
am.
Question. Now, as somebody who's a poet and also has a press, are you ever uncomfortable having to judge other people's work? Did you ever you know, second-guess yourself about some of
that? It's not that I'm uncomfortable. It's just that it gets difficult. When you get, for instance, if you have a poetry book competition or a chapbook competition, as we do, when you get down, maybe you've got 200-300 entries. When you get down to the top 20-25, frankly, almost all of them could be published.
Wow.
Those top ones, you really could do that. And at that point, it becomes very, you get past the technique and everything, and it becomes very much it depends on who's doing the reading. We always have several readers.
Mm.
And for our full-length poetry book competition, we bring in an outside judge for the last 20 or 25.
Wow, that must be
difficult.
But
for the chapbook, it's done there, and it is hard toward the end. It is very hard.
Now, do you work as a mentor for a lot of people? Do you have writers that you think have potential but need a little bit of guidance? Are you available for that?
I've done workshops for adults and periodically do that. I mostly work with youth, college and high school interns, and the kids in our workshops. It's just there's only so much you can do. And we made our focus on the readings and the publishing, and we built a beautiful library there. And we made our focus those things rather than, say, adult writing workshops, because they tend to need to go on for quite a long time. And there's only so much time, basically.
Well, how do you inspire some of the older kids? I know the little kids are just being introduced, but some of the older kids, what do you give them advice? How do you,
you know,
pass on inspiration?
It's really funny. They love to write poems, and they don't need a lot of inspiration. I think one of the things that puts people off on poetry sometimes is you get the people who say, I hate poetry, and I can't even deal with that.
I know, I can't either.
I can't even go there. But because poetry's so elemental. And with kids, it helps if you don't confront them with the big topics. If you confront them, if you give them the small topics, the glass of water or whatever, and you start the way Neruda does with those wonderful odes. I have them write odes to, as he did, common things. You write an ode to salt, and after that, you can write a love poem, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting to me. You know, I think it's interesting that I have it in my notes that T.S. Eliot wrote, immature poets imitate, mature poets steal.
There you go.
I thought that was a wonderful. How do you feel about that?
That's wonderful. I never heard that. I never heard that quote, but I like it a lot. Why not?
You must find that too, because you work with so many people who are just starting, you know, using this kind of language.
You know, and it's a wonderful way to get started. I mean, when I read ancient Japanese poems to sixth graders, it's a wonderful way for them to learn how a poem goes.
Yeah.
And why not use that? Because then they see something in a different way than they've ever seen it before.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I know, poetry really does take what is normal sight in life and turns it into this magical.
It does.
Magical way of communicating.
It does. I love the lyric poem, that moment, that wonderful microscopic moment.
Have you ever been fond of rhyming poetry? That seems to be out of style for most poets that I have talked to, at least in the last few years.
I think it's less out of style now. I think it's getting back in style. I do a lot of slant rhyme.
Mm.
I usually don't let my students do rhyming because it's too hard.
It is.
It's too easy to lose the poem to the rhyme.
And it's too easy to get corny with the some of the words you have to, you know, pull out of the
I find villanelles a wonderful challenge because of the rhyming. And if I have, you know, kids who are a little more advanced, I'll have them do villanelles. And they often do.
Explain
some
to people
things.
What that means.
A villanelle is a French form. French, Italian, I can't remember.
It's French.
Yeah. It's a wonderful form of, let's see, four stanzas of three lines each, and then the last one is four lines, and the first and third lines rhyme, and in some of those you repeat those lines, so you have to keep this thing, it's a beautiful musical form, and one of the best examples is Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gently Into That Good Night, and Elizabeth Bishop's the one about losing isn't hard to master. And those are beautiful, beautiful villanelles and very hard to do. And Red Keys, I Knew a Woman Lovely in Her Bones.
Ah.
Those are beautiful.
Yeah.
And they're, you can't, very hard to surpass those.
Yeah. I know that there are some styles of poetry that I wouldn't even try to attempt.
Yeah.
Now, you also do translations. You did the epic poem Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Well, I worked on Beowulf for about 12 years.
Wow.
Long time.
What was the original language? Is it Old English?
It's Old English or Anglo-Saxon, and that's a Germanic language. And it's very far removed from our contemporary English. You'll find a word now and then. You say, oh, yeah, okay. But it's quite far removed. And I worked on that 12 years. I love the story. I just love heroes. And so I worked on that a long time, and then it was published. And I've just about completed the Anglo-Saxon riddles. It's 90-some riddles, all in Old English, and they're going to be published this year, late this year.
Wow, that is amazing.
And those are so much fun.
How do you do the research for what Old English words mean in our language?
I study a lot. I'm a real self-studier.
You're a real scholar, aren't you?
Yes, but I'm very much a solitary scholar. Mm. You know, I do it myself. And I read a lot. So I'll read a whole lot of versions of various translations, and I'll read about the grammar structure and, you know, all of that, the bones of the language. And
well, so you must consult with somebody on that, because that seems so complicated. Aren't there professors who...
No, actually.
Really?
When Beowulf was about to be published, I asked Graham Duncan, who was a professor at Suco in Oneonta for many years. I asked him to read it at the end for any little stupid errors, anything I might have missed.
Would he know?
well, Graham had gone to Cornell, and he had studied Beowulf himself, and he's a wonderful scholar. He's just wonderful, and at the end, it was very important for me to have somebody look at that and sort of say, well, yes, it's okay. It's okay.
Is it a beautiful language that we're sorry that we've lost? Or?
It's a guttural language, but it has a wonderful rhythm. And one of the things I did was, there are three or four new translations of Beowulf every year.
Yeah,
everybody's
yeah.
translating Beowulf. So I listened to Kent Malone, who was a Beowulf scholar. He had read it on the old Cadman records in the original Anglo-Saxon.
Mm.
And I started this a long time ago. I used to ride around New York with my Walkman on my bicycle listening to Beowulf and Kent Malone. Because to me, the most important thing was to get the rhythm of the language.
Mm.
And I think I succeeded there. And several reviewers who knew, quote unquote, said I got that rhythm down too.
Wow, so, that's amazing.
Because I thought it's an oral language. It's meant to be spoken. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that to happen, that people could hear it the way I thought it should be.
So say a couple sentences in it, can you?
Well, the beginning of it, I haven't looked at it lately, is it's like Wetwe gardena in your dagum theod kininga frim yofrunen ua abalengans. And that's, listen, we know the story of the Spear Danes and the old kings. And
wow, that's amazing. It almost does sound like Gaelic. I mean, at least your accent does.
Yeah, and it's the closest language to it today is Frisian, and that's very close to the old Anglo-Saxon.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, we only have about a minute left. Can you give us some contact information so people can get in touch if they'd like?
Yeah, they could contact me at Bright Hill Center, which is 607-829-5055. They could go to the brighthillpress.org website, and we also do the New York State Literary website, which is nyslittree.org.
Well, that's great. Well, Bertha Rogers, thank you so much for joining us. And again, her latest book is called Heart Turned Back. Please go out and get it. It's wonderful stuff. Bertha Rogers, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish. My pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our fiscal sponsor is the New York Foundation for the Arts in Brooklyn, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.